Toledo, we're famous for Glass, Art Tatum, Tony Pacos, Jamie Farr, a world-class museum, the Toledo Mud Hens and Walleye, an outstanding zoo and public library system. But who are the people that make our city so great? Welcome to the Soul of the Glass City podcast. I'm your host, Monique. The guests just keep getting cooler and cooler. And I am so happy to say that not only is this a friend, he's dang near like a brother to me, and, you know, just been doing his thing for a very long time. I have LaShawn Shaw on my podcast today. So amazing. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Doing well, Monique. Thank you very much for inviting me here.
I'm so happy to have you. So you are a very, very proud Toledo native, born and raised. Please tell us about that.
Yeah, so 41 years old, like you're saying, born and raised here in Toledo, Ohio. So I've lived on like every single side of Toledo. I grew up on Waite initially, down the street from Robinson High School, went to Martin Luther King when it was not a boys' school, when it was an integrated school between boys and girls. Then I moved out, went to Hawkins, then the McTighe, Rogers, and then I moved onto the east side of town where I went to Waite and graduated as an Indian. So got a little bit of Ram and Indian blood in me.
Okay. Yeah. So you basically are cool with everybody then.
Oh, yeah, you know.
So we've spoken in the past, and you mentioned before that you didn't meet your dad till you were like 9 years old. Why is that significant to your story?
I have an interesting relationship, an amazing relationship with both my parents and my family as a whole. So, you know, a little bit about my backstory. I was raised by the matriarch of our family, our great grandma, Grandma Hill, rest in peace. She died at 101 years old. Wow. Born in 1913, she actually lived in Tennessee, Nashville, Tennessee specifically, and then she moved up to Toledo after a time where she actually became a nurse in Nashville, you know. So I just think about that time period and, you know, what she had to go through in order to accomplish that. She had my grandma had my mom. I did not actually really live with my mom until I was around 3 years old. You know, of course, teenage parents, you know, they're going through a lot of struggles, a lot of conflict with each other as well, too, you know, as is unfortunately common in a lot of our households. And because of that, it did result in me not meeting my dad until I was like 9 years old. And I was one of those kids, you know, people would make fun of me like, hey, you ain't got a dad. You don't have a dad. And I was like, I got a dad. He's somewhere. Oh, you know, I was confident, so you know, he was somewhere and he was looking for me, you know. So I have an amazing relationship with my dad and have ever since, you know. He's definitely taken me under his wing, you know, provided me with a lot of different skill sets, understanding, opening up his network, and also just watching him as a nonprofit leader for the last 25 years in Toledo, Ohio has been an amazing journey as well, too. So I think that's kind of why it encapsulates a lot of, you know, who I am today, you know, as a family man as well, too.
Did your mom ever explain to you where your dad was?
It was one of those scenarios where I knew both sides were going to have a story. And at the end of the day, the only thing that mattered is that they were there then. So I've heard the story. You know, it's definitely one of those interesting stories from both angles, you know. But it also tells what they were going through at that time as well, too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just to have that understanding, you know, it meant a lot to me. So regardless to the fact that there was some, you know, missing time, the things that they have done to make up for that have been beyond immense for me.
That's a big blessing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now I know you as a big family man, a doting husband, an amazing father. Do you feel like your upbringing had an impact on how you lead your family and parent your children now?
100%. I have four kids. I've been married 16 years to my wonderful wife, Brittany. My son's Aiden, his birthday was just literally yesterday, he turned 14. I wanted to have a very close-knit family, you know, as I stated, you know, learning from, you know, the matriarch of our family. Keeping everybody close, keeping family close is really important. Never giving up on them is very important as well, too. And also being to have an input on their life experience is very important. So for me to keep everybody together, you know, for me to be able to say that I am very much involved. I've been a PTO dad. I've coached various different sports. I know nothing about soccer, but I was out there doing, you know, my soccer thing. I've done, you know, basketball for my daughter. I was a coach for her team, and even flag football, you know. So I stay involved everywhere that I can with my kids because I understand that I'm giving them something that I didn't have at that time. And I understand the impact that could potentially have on them as well, too. So it's really important to me. Big deal.
You didn't play any sports growing up?
I played a lot of basketball.
Okay.
But interesting story. So my dad was a football star. He was king of Scott High School for Afro Ball. And he also was a track star. So I consider myself pretty fast. So when I got to high school, I went to Rogers. And Rogers is truly full of really fast individuals. Like, if you want to see if you can measure up, you know, that was at that time a really good place to go. And I went there. I tried out for the team. I made the team. I was supposed to run the 800. And then the first time that I ended up having to run a race, I had to run the 3200. And that is way longer than what I had prepared for, which is basically just a sprint twice around the track. And now I had to do it like 16 times. So I remember the gun going off and I bolted off. And I remember like the third lap looking behind me and I was like, I am really beating these guys. Like, they are super slow and I am great. And and then like the sixth lap, I started slowing down because I'm like, this is still happening now. Like, this is starting to hurt. And then the eighth lap, I started to get lapped by people. And then like the 10th and every lap after that, I'm pretty sure I was the only one that was on the track. And by the time I finished, my mom was in the stands and everybody clapped for me like I just finished the Special Olympics, which was awesome. And I went to the car. I remember taking off my jersey and I threw it in the bottom of my locker room. And I said, Mom, I'll just be popular. I don't have to play sports. I'll just be popular. And I just worked on that from that point.
Did you think that if you would have did the other one, that you would have been good at it and then it would have been a whole different
trajectory? I had an idea that it would have been, but I don't think it would have worked out nearly as well as it did.
Because you went to the school with all the fast people.
Everybody was much faster than I thought. So,
okay.
Yeah,
that is such a fun story. Talk about your education and what you do now.
Yeah. So high school graduate. I went to college a lot. I started off going to college in high school. I went to like a Jim Jackson program, got to meet Jim Jackson, great guy, of course, from Toledo, Ohio. And then I also did a law program with Calvin Lawshe, RIP to Calvin Lawshe, an amazing program where I was introduced to everything about law. And honestly, that should have been the trajectory that I took. Everybody when I was growing up told me, you know, you argue a lot, you should be a lawyer and everything like that. But I was not bright enough to have the understanding, like, you're in a law program and all you got to do is take that next step. So it kind of was what it was. So I ended up going back to Owens, business administration and psychology, because, of course, the very first time that you're going to school, why not split a major and do both at the exact same time? And I got to a point where it was like, either you're going to work and you're going to pay bills because you want to be an adult that's out here with a car and you're paying and, you know, maybe want to go on dates every once in a while, or I was going to go to school, you know. So I tried school a few different times. I went back for psychology, business administration. I went for at one point I wanted to edit movies. So I ended up back at Owens, but Owens did not have any sort of film product or program at that point. So I ended up going for, it was like plays or something, you know, it was like all about staging and plays and everything like that. And I didn't really have an affinity for it, but I still continued to like write movie scripts on the back end and everything like that. And it just became a point where I had a realization that a lot of people can say, hey, I have this degree or I have this skill. I'm a good woodworker. I can draw really, really well. And what I had was me. I was like my own brand. You know, I had to lean really heavily into the idea of your network is your net worth. You know, the first impression is, you know, the only impression that you can make. And then really diving into the ideas behind that. You know, how do you make a really good impression on individuals? What kind of settings do you need to do that in? So much to the point where I started to go to interviews for jobs that I knew I would not want or probably would not get. And it became to be a practice model for me, because at some point I was going to have that interview that I really wanted, and I wanted to go out there and kill it. So for me, school was something that always in the back of the mind seemed like it was something that I needed to do. I always got into roles where individuals would say, well, we would promote you, but you don't have a degree. And I'm like, well, if I had a degree in art, you would promote me here in healthcare. And it wasn't a notion that I could really get behind, because here I am. I had started off in customer service. My very first job was actually a bill collector, which went over awesome. It really taught me how to deal with people on the phone, how to set expectations, and also, in my opinion, how to work smarter and not harder. You know, I saw a lot of people that I came out of high school with were doing like hard and manual labor jobs, and I don't like being cold, I don't like being hot, I don't like being uncomfortable. So I was like, I'll work office jobs, you know. So I was a customer service rep for quite some time, and then I ended up working as a store manager for a Sprint store. And at that point, I was like assistant manager, and I was doing like 70 hours a week. I had just had my second child. I didn't have any insurance. And it just so happened that I wanted to work at Medical Mutual for a very long time. And someone came in, and he was a salesman for Medical Mutual. And he's like, hey, you should come over and do sales. And I'm like, I'm not doing sales. It's not like I'm not doing any more sales. But he said, you should come over and you should, you know, talk to maybe someone on the customer service side. So I went over to Medical Mutual for some time. I was a benefit claim adjudicator. Learned all about insurance benefits. So if you guys ever have questions about what your benefits look like or your policies, that's something I can still help out with, because that was drilled into my head for quite some time. But I kept running into that like proverbial glass ceiling, you know, one of those things where I would continue to see everybody around me. And I was like, I want my boss's job. I don't want the job that I currently have. And I want my boss's job, in fact. And once I hit that ceiling, I would always just move. I'm like, I can always find a job that's going to pay me more, because they're out there, you know. So I got a taste of that, and I moved over to like a family-owned company, Managed Care Advisory Group out of Sylvania, Ohio, which was actually an audit company where they audited doctors' offices and hospitals. I left there. I ended up moving over to ProMedica, where I was a customer service manager there. And I was like, man, I'm back on the phones again. This is killing me. Fortunately, though, someone literally came up to me and said, I love your voice on the phone. Like, I love to hear you on the phone. I love to hear you talk. I could literally just sit there and listen to you like talk all the time. And somehow, some way, that ended up morphing itself into an interview for a job where I literally went into the job to be a trainer. And they were like, yeah, never mind any of that. You have a good skill set in molding teams, and that's what we really need to happen. So instead of you being a trainer, don't you want to manage the team? And I'm like, sure, you know, why not? So I had a very highly skilled training team that was under me while I was at ProMedica. That allowed me the opportunity to do a lot of epic training on that particular platform for all of the different various ProMedica offices throughout the state. And then COVID hit. And at that time, I was actually a office manager for ProMedica at that point, and I had two practices. And I remember a time quite after COVID, because we had made it through. We actually had one of the first offices that had seen a COVID patient, one of the first offices that were doing telemedicine views at that, or office visits at that point as well too. So about a year or so down the line, I'm looking at, you know, my skill set and the work that I've done, and I'm like, you know, I should be paid more. And of course, there's that ceiling again. And it's like, you don't have a degree, but I'm like, I have two practices. And it just came a point where I ended up getting out of healthcare, and I ended up hearing about a company that was going to remodel the Jefferson. And my honest thought was, who the heck would remodel the Jefferson, and why would they remodel the Jefferson?
That thing was horrible.
It was. You know, it had been down there dilapidated. You know, I would tell people all the time that homeless people were doing everything that ended in ing, eating, sleeping on those steps, you know, living on those steps, unfortunately, and fortunately for them. You know, so I ended up doing some research, and you know, I'll probably trigger some people when I say it. I ended up finding out the company was called Bitwise. So I hear about Bitwise and how they're this economic development engine out of Fresno, California, and how they go into underserved communities and offer jobs and are able to create equitable pathways to tech or tech adjacent positions. And the thing that I really heard is that if you are an apprentice with Bitwise, they will start you off with $70,000, unlimited paid time off, unlimited childcare, or excuse me, free childcare, and free benefits as well, too. And I'm like, well, that's somewhere I want to be. And their mission and their model for what they were doing in other cities, I saw as something that if we could accomplish that here in Toledo, that we could do even better. So I started off with being an apprentice. At a point where I had been out of a job for about 8 months, and my wife's looking at me like, why are you not trying to get a paid position somewhere? Love her for believing in me. And I ended up finding a role in operations. So we'll speed forward through it a little bit. I start off as director of operations for Toledo, Ohio. 6 months later, I'm made the vice president of operations for Toledo. Months after that, I am actually in Washington, D.C., speaking at the at Congress, you know, speaking to some of the congressmen and their offices in Washington, D.C. on behalf of Toledo, Ohio, talking about how to bring workforce, economic, and just transformation dollars to Toledo, Ohio, Chicago, and New York as a whole. And unfortunately, and maybe even fortunately, honestly, Bitwise went under. You know, in one night, they called everybody on Memorial Day 2023 at 11 o'clock, said everybody's got to get on a call. I knew immediately we were getting fired because no one calls you on a holiday at 11 o'clock and tells everyone, all 900 people, to get on the call. I've been there before. And unfortunately, they dropped the bomb on everybody and they said, we're going to furlough everybody. And I knew that was bad because only government gets furloughed. I was like, we're never coming back. And but what I knew was, what they had inspired in Toledo was something that we could accomplish on our own. You know, we had the money, we had the talent, we had the people, we had the skill set, and I wanted to be able to reignite that. So unfortunately, that notion fell on deaf ears initially. Fortunately, though, as I am always on LinkedIn, there was a guy by the name of Tom Bush that at that time was working with Amazon. And he reached out to my boss at that point, Tammy Sherman, and said, hey, this is something I would love to reignite. You know, maybe the right mission, wrong model. How can we do this again for Toledo? And she gave me his information, and I reached out to him. And I started having meetings with him, and I started seeing how bright he was and how innovative and forward-thinking that he was when it came to what Toledo could be and what we could accomplish. And it really had a lot of alignment with what I was already doing. So we kind of launched into this idea of using artificial intelligence as the catalyst for how could we turn Toledo into the AI capital of the Midwest. And I think it's really important to have the understanding that there are a lot of people that are on that, you know, imaginary street that you're currently on, where there's one side of that street where people are in fear of artificial intelligence. It's the devil. It's Terminator. It's going to take our jobs.
iRobot.
All of that. All of that. And that's all understandable. Mm-hmm. But that side's frozen. And then you have the other side of the street that is kind of playing with AI in this frivolous sense, where it's like, I'm going to make this picture of me looking all buff. I'm going to make Jay-Z do a Gatsby rap as if he was a cat. The interesting thing about both those sides of the street is they're all going to get washed away with the tech wave. And if they don't figure out the advancement, either in workforce, economic development, or personal development that comes along with artificial intelligence, they're going to be scrambling to reach the top of that tide. And that's going to be a hard journey. And what I recognize for Toledo is that we have always been, I don't want to say last in line, but when it comes to like the three C's, we come behind Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Columbus. And we stand there and we're almost like at this point okay with our position. And I think that if we kind of reimagine the narrative for Toledo, you know, what we could potentially be with saying that we could be the Midwest location, the hub for attracting, retaining, and training the best tech talent here locally, that we could reimagine what Toledo could truly be. And that's why when, you know, my partner Tom told me about the mantra of pursuing the AI capital of the Midwest for Ohio, that was something that I definitely wanted to shoot for, because it's our time.
That is true. Why do you think it's important to see people who look like us, you know, people of color in the tech space? Why do you think that's important?
I'll give you an interesting story. So I've only been using artificial intelligence for probably about 2 years. And I remember my nephew Mason kept telling me, like, hey, there's this new thing, ChatGPT, it's out. You know, it can write you a rap. And I'm like, I don't care because I'm not a rapper. But there finally came a point where he came up to me and he said, just ask it a question, you know, and see what it says. And I did it, and I was really surprised by what came out. And it was probably months that had gone by before I ended up having that follow-up conversation with Tom, and he started telling me it's about diving into ChatGPT and everything like that. And one of the first things that I did when I really started deciding that I was going to, you know, really dive into artificial intelligence, ChatGPT has an image generator called DALL-E. And I went to DALL-E and I took my 23andMe, which I had just recently got back, that said I was like 76% sub-Saharan African and 20% Irish, which I had no idea. And I threw that in and I gave my own personal description of what I looked like. And I asked the image generator to make a picture of me. And the results were very interesting. So none of them created me. They were black men. But when I said, no, you know, I need this mixture, I need it to look like this, one of the things that it ended up creating was an image where it was literally quite half of the face was white and half of the face was black. And for me, it was striking because I had this idea or notion that it could not produce an image that looked like me because there were not enough people on the back end working to create images that look like me. Mm. And that's inherently a problem, but it's also a problem that has been widespread when it comes to tech. You know, it's very few people that you can see that are from black and brown communities that were able to take advantage of like the internet wave when it first came out, or Google when it first came out, or Apple because they knew that it was going to end up blowing up. And artificial intelligence is this generation's light bulb, quite literally. So for our community to sit around either in frivolousness or in fear without the lights on, we're going to end up tripping on quite a few things. We're going to run into a lot of different barriers and obstacles that if we would just take the opportunity to step into that same realm of unknown that everybody else has to step into for personal advancement, that we could uplift ourselves. So the idea of augmenting ourselves with artificial intelligence and not just giving AI a task and saying, go off and do it, and what you produce is what I see as something that should be utilized. That should not be how it works. We need to be augmenting ourselves with the ideas that we currently have to tell the stories, because we often have the talent, but that opportunity is not as widespread. We often have the talent, but we are not able to tell that story as well. So artificial intelligence kind of mitigates that gap of saying, hey, if you have the talent, you have the idea, and there's a certain vernacular or format that you need to put that in, combine that with the AI and get the product that you're looking for at that point. And I think it's truly important that we as a community really have the understanding of the personal, the economic, and workforce development that this artificial intelligence specifically can bring to our community.
I just want to say you're also really big into activism, and there's one particular project that I want you to highlight, the one with the AI and the books and the kids, please.
Yeah, sure. So as I stated earlier, we have the for-profit Actual Reality Technologies, but we also have a nonprofit called Empowered AI. And we wrote a grant last year that we ended up receiving funding for through the City of Toledo Parks and Recreation Department. That particular grant allowed us to create an opportunity called Young Empowered Authors. And Young Empowered Authors was our way of introducing artificial intelligence to youth the ages between 7 and 12, but for a very specific purpose. I don't think you should just give anybody AI and say, run off and use it. But if you give them a very specific purpose, goal, or milestone, I think that as long as you're alongside them, you can accomplish some really amazing things. So what we ended up doing, we had a four-day session, four half-day sessions where we actually introduced kids to artificial intelligence. And when I say we introduced them to that, we actually started off with the notions of this is plagiarism, this is trademarking, this is copyright, because we want to make sure that we are not infringing on anything. You know, we want to make sure that this is a truly creative process for the kids. And we wanted to make sure that they were bringing in their own ideas for stories as well, too. So no one could say, like, the AI created the books, even though it did assist. Absolutely. So what we ended up doing in those 4 days, we introduced kids to a bit of the digital literacy piece, as we did provide each and every student with their own laptop that they were able to take home at the end of the program, because you have to close the digital divide. It's a big deal to have an understanding that if kids don't have something to practice on when they go home, you're really, in essence, doing them a disservice. So we introduced them to ChatGPT, Leonardo, and Canva. And we utilized that toolkit in order for all 40 of these kids to publish their own books. So all 40 of these books are available on Amazon KDP. We threw the kids a really lavish party in partnership with the University of Toledo Business Incubator as well, that we called the Publisher's Party. And the goal of that was to recognize these kids on a really grand level, you know, something that you would see in like a California, Chicago, Atlanta, Miami, you know, red carpet event. We had a step and repeat photo shoot. We had paparazzi there snapping pictures of them. We live streamed the event on YouTube. Senator Paula Hicks Hudson, which I know was one of your guests previously, shout out to her. She actually came and did a closing remarks for our event. And then State Representative Josh Williams came and did a keynote speech as well, too. We had 23 sponsors in kind for the event. So major shout out to our sponsors such as Taylor Automotive Family and Mud Made, who partnered with us in order to create the shirts for the kids as well, too. And we even purchased 600 books for the kids through a company locally called Mirror Printing. The idea behind that was that we wanted the kids to have that entrepreneurial spirit and to actually sell their books at the publisher's party. So each kid received 15 books. A lot of the kids sold out of their books, so they went home with $150 in their pocket, which was amazing as well, too.
That's so crazy. I love it.
Yeah. And since that point, we've had kids go on to sell hundreds of books, you know, so it's been really, really amazing.
Love to hear it. Do you see Toledo being a tech mecca in the future? And would you like to leave us with any closing remarks?
Absolutely. Toledo will be a tech hub. Toledo's future is going to be leaning into tech and having an understanding of how we can infuse tech in nonprofits, for-profit organizations, our personal lives, our child's lives, and everyone, you know, for us to truly be a tech hub. There's a lot of things that we can do. There's a lot of people that have already been moving in this space as well, too. So, you know, major shout outs to everyone that has continued to keep that fire burning. But we can absolutely, and we will absolutely be a top-notch tech hub here in Toledo, Ohio.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing this like amazing like story of yours and the revelations and the activism, all of it. Love it.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate it. This has been an amazing experience.
Thank you everyone for listening. I'm your host and producer, Monique. My executive producer is Chris Piper. Join me next time for another exciting episode of Soul of the Glass City podcast. For more information, if you have questions or comments, go to wgte.org/soul.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.